Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey. Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer. We've got Dr. Carl here. And we're going to be going over the top line results that people are going crazy about on the news. The Surmount 5 top line results, which pitted the Zepbound branded tirzepatide against the Wegovy branded semaglutide. My brother's going to talk about the results from before where they actually did tirzepatide versus semaglutide for type 2 diabetes. But this one was for obesity specifically. Then we're also going to talk about some of the cardiorenal protection that we see from GLP-1 agonists and go over some hot takes on some of the compounding stuff that's going on with the GLP-1 agonists. The ADA just came out with a statement about compounded versions, and we'll get into that. There's some other interesting things going on that it's just some legislation potentially stuff with the FDA working with Novo and Lilly and some interesting stuff, and we'll get all into it. So let's go into the top line results from Surmount 5.
All right. Holy cow. Well, first of all, this is not published. So once upon a time, you know, we didn't know about these studies until they were published, and they only get published well before usually, in a lot of trials, they get published before things are even approved. Obviously, these have been around for a while, and this has been something people have been looking forward to, the Zepbound versus Wegovy brand names, but tirzepatide versus semaglutide for people with obesity without type 2 diabetes. So I say that because we've talked a lot about in our other podcasts how all the data historically show that people who have already progressed in their obesity complicated by insulin resistance, prediabetes, to the point of having criteria for type 2 diabetes, don't lose as much weight on any type of medication, diet, exercise, or even surgery as people do if they haven't quite progressed to that level yet. So a couple of years ago, there was a trial in people with obesity and type 2 diabetes, which pitted tirzepatide, brand name in that case, Mounjaro, versus semaglutide, brand name in that case, Ozempic. And back then, it only went up to 1 milligram of the Ozempic. So nowadays, we do have the 2 milligram version. We can kind of talk about what that means. I can tell you that 1 milligram versus 2 milligram has been studied, and it's not like it's the most dramatic difference anyhow. So to give you an idea about this, this was 2,000 patients who had obesity with type 2 diabetes. Their average hemoglobin A1C 8.3%. So to give some context for average blood sugar control, we always want to try to get most people down to an A1C under 7%, which is about an average blood sugar of 155. There's some nuances with that. Older patients with more complications, frailty, depending on what kind of medications we use, sometimes we just want to get them to 8%. But a lot of people, young people without insulin and using medications like these, we wouldn't mind essentially normalizing their blood sugars down to A1Cs close to 6, even below in theory. And so this trial was shorter than the one we're going to talk about. It was 40 weeks, and the average weight loss for those who were assigned to Ozempic was 7%. With that, they had almost a 2% hemoglobin A1C improvement. It was 1.9%. Now, this is, by the way, remarkable, because several years ago, even back when we had the first GLP-1 receptor agonist, when I was in med school doing endocrine rotations, I mean, it wasn't getting anywhere near this. They were the best we had at the time. That was exenatide, Byetta. And, you know, we get over 1%, 1.5%, but not generally 2% A1C reduction, and definitely not the 7% weight loss in people with type 2 diabetes. But then the Mounjaro arm, the tirzepatide arm, with 5 milligrams was getting on average 8.5% weight loss, with 10 milligrams, 11% weight loss, and then with the 15 milligrams, 13% weight loss. And those correlated to A1C reductions of 2 and then 2.4 and 2.3 respectively. So actually the 10 and the 15 were pretty similar in that. So that was in obesity with type 2 diabetes. Okay. So now top line results, again, not published. We don't have all the details. We have the very, very minimal basics, but this was 72 weeks for people with obesity. They had to have at least one obesity related disorder disease, not including type 2 diabetes. So high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, et cetera. And it was a phase 3B and it was open label. So it wasn't blinded. So people knew if they were getting essentially Wegovy or Zepbound. Unless the actual publication corrects me on that. And it was a lower number of people in this trial. It was 750 people. They were just randomized 1-to-1. And they did titrate them up to max tolerated doses. So in the Wegovy or the semaglutide arm, that's 1.7 or 2.4 milligrams. Those are the doses approved for chronic use. Whereas in the Zepbound, while 5 milligrams is approved, they actually titrated them up to either 10 or 15 milligrams, depending on what was tolerated. So just to be fair. And the bottom line up front results that were, of course, let loose by the company, probably to get investors excited, is it was an average of 20% mean weight loss versus 14% essentially for the two groups. And so that's a pretty substantial weight reduction for both arms, mind you. We talk a lot about how achieving 10% weight loss is now really the standard we should be getting, because that's where we start to see the most clinical benefits, blood pressure, lipids, diabetes markers, fatty liver, all that starts to improve. And when we start getting over 15%, that's where we really, really, really start to put a lot of these disease states in remission. So those were the average weight losses. And then the secondary endpoints, we always talk about, well, how many people were able to get 10, 15 or more percent weight loss? And this is really where I think it's always just spectacular. And a third of people in the Zepbound tirzepatide group were able to achieve 25% weight loss, 16%, still pretty darn good, in the semaglutide Wegovy arm were able to get that. And I mean, that, you know, that's pretty remarkable. So we talk about 25% weight loss being kind of like getting bariatric metabolic surgery.
Yeah, I posted about this. These results aren't surprising. We all had to say we have to wait for head-to-head trials to kind of to say exactly, but we think given that they're in similar populations, we could kind of compare them. But now we have head-to-head results. They look about what to be expected. Tirzepatide is a more powerful drug than semaglutide when it comes to weight. And for blood sugar control, we're waiting on the cardiovascular outcome trial, which is slightly different in the tirzepatide, the way they designed it versus the semaglutide, that SELECT trial that we've made multiple podcasts on in the past. But if I had to guess, I would say we're going to see similar cardiovascular benefits, or should I say cardiovascular benefits, if you're from
the Midwest. Because we're in the Midwest,
the Chicago. Al Capone. Yeah.
Certainly. Anyway. And the data are reassuring, you know, the analyses of all the phase three trials suggest a significant cardiovascular benefit, but we do. It's a different type of molecule. It's different than just GLP-1 receptor agonism, like all the other medications that we're going to talk about in this next meta-analysis. So it really does need to be proven.
Yeah, it does. It's a powerful drug. I mean, and the other thing is what I want to see more so than these top line weight loss results, because we already know they work really well. I want to see the side effect profile differences, because anecdotally we see tirzepatide is better tolerated. There's mechanistic data to suggest of why that is. However, I don't know. We're going to see the top line results and what they wrote up said very similar adverse events. We're going to get into the nitty gritty when that comes out. So why don't we move on to the cardiorenal protection stuff?
All right. So there have been a lot of these different types of publications over recent years because generally speaking, the individual medications, semaglutide known as Ozempic, dulaglutide known as Trulicity, et cetera, have had cardiovascular outcome trials, generally speaking, showing benefit with some nuances with some of the older ones not quite showing statistical benefit. But this was both heart and kidney meta-analysis that was just published like right around Thanksgiving in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. And they were looking at some 11 of the biggest trials of these medications, essentially the cardiovascular, the kidney trials of the variety of medications. They were looking at both kidney outcomes, and they used a composite of kidney failure, like your kidneys stop working, basically, and or 50% reduction in kidney function, or death from kidney disease. And then they looked at the classic cardiovascular outcomes, which are death from heart disease or non-death strokes or heart attacks. And so 11 of the trials, it had 85,000 patients, mostly male. So it's interesting because in the obesity trials, now these are mostly diabetes, other than select that they did include. The obesity trials usually has more females. These were mostly type 2 diabetes, so it was a little bit more males. 67,000 overall had type 2 diabetes, and they looked at trials such as Rewind with dulaglutide or the Trulicity cardiovascular outcome trial, going back to Leader, the liraglutide or Victoza trial from several years ago, the different semaglutide or Ozempic trials, both in diabetes and kidney disease, and then in obesity without diabetes but heart disease, select the oral semaglutide or Rybelsus trial, exenatide, Byetta, and Bydureon, the ligzizenatide trial, which we only have ligzizenatide available in combination with basal insulin, that's called Soliqua, and then the one we've alluded to this one before, the not very potent for weight and blood sugar, albaglutide, which we had available back when I was in fellowship, but it actually fell off the market just because I think maybe it wasn't competitive or something, even though while it didn't have great weight and blood sugar reduction, it did have very statistically significant reduction in the cardiovascular events. So these were all the things that were included. And the bottom line is that it showed significant reduction in all these different outcomes. So an 18% reduction in the composite kidney outcomes, a 13% reduction in those major cardiovascular outcomes, a 12% relative reduction in death. And when they combined select, so that was mostly for the studies that included type 2 diabetes, but for select, when they included it in the meta-analysis, it was a 19% reduction in kidney outcomes, 16% reduction in heart outcomes, and 13% reduction in for dying. And very important, going back to the whole safety thing that we got in our argument with Jillian Michaels and tried to discuss the nuances. This one specifically really pointed out the pancreatitis risk and no difference from placebo.
Statistical difference.
And in fact, the hazard ratio was 0.95 for the medications, meaning if anything, it was numerically better.
Huh.
So no statistically significant difference, maybe even some benefit, which, you know, I've always suggested that if we make sure we're treating all the basic causes of pancreatitis, in a lot of these patients, triglycerides can be included in that. And these medications should help. Yeah. And now, you know, can we talk about your trial? It was a retrospective data. These medications help people with their diet, their weight, which reduces triglycerides, which reduces risk of pancreatitis. And maybe as Spencer and some of his old colleagues just published it, they may help people reduce their alcohol intake, which is a really high driver of pancreatitis.
It was a retrospective. Well, the kind of the way we did it actually was interesting. When I set up the intake form for all these patients that
and
come in.
And let's be clear, you didn't do shit, but go on.
They all put in their baseline alcohol intake. And then what we did is we followed up later and then asked them during a refill, and gave them the same survey and just looked at what happened. There wasn't an intervention, meaning it's not a trial where we gave somebody a placebo versus some sort of drug. And the way we set it up is we just kind of looked at what happens, and we used metformin as the reference and kind of looked from there. This was published in JAMA Open as a research letter. So it wasn't like a, and you're kind of limited to how much you can put in there and describe the study. But essentially, all the people in there were decreasing, on average, their alcohol intake.
Yeah. And it's not the only one. It's not like this is not a one-off. I mean, there's a reason you guys looked into this, and that's because the reports have been adding up. There are other similar publications such as yours, which have come out recently. So now there are going to be, so these are all, we call them hypothesis generating, sort of studies.
Yeah, it starts off as anecdotes. We hear that. So I had some viral TikToks, stupid TikTok, but TikToks went viral. I basically said, hey, I had a few patients, this is a few years ago, who just don't want to drink alcohol anymore. Is this your experience? And boom, boom, boom. Oh my gosh, I'm experiencing that. But the other cool thing is we do naltrexone and bupropion. People know it as Contrave. We prescribe them generically separately to make it cheaper oftentimes. And same thing, naltrexone is literally FDA approved for alcohol cessation. We saw the same types of reductions. So pretty cool to see that. There are actual clinical trials right now going on that should be placebo blinded for specifically alcohol cessation. Again, I say this all the time, but I think we're going to see all sorts of indications popping up for these drugs. Whether it actually gets FDA approved for that versus like, hey, we can use this off label. Mm-hmm. I think that I have a few really good board certified addiction medicine doctor friends who are starting to dabble in this. The concern would be if they don't have obesity and could be thin already from, malnutrition from over ingestion of alcohol and not actual food, you got to be careful not to like make them lose more weight. But hopefully if it helps them come off the alcohol and allows them to start eating actual food and they would actually get nourished better. I don't know, though. This is why they need to study it.
That's why it needs to be studied. That actually brings up, I just heard this little anecdote from a patient today and his wife, and he is somebody with obesity, type 2 diabetes, who's done really well overall on semaglutide, known as Ozempic, for a variety of reasons. We're actually kind of apropos for what we've talked about, we're actually going to switch him to tirzepatide in the form of Mounjaro tentatively. But they were asking me about my thoughts on these, online places selling the compounded semaglutides and the tirzepatides. And unfortunately, they told me about this. And I we don't want to throw anybody under the bus. Everyone's trying to do the best they can. But they have some family members who apparently got some of these meds, these drugs from, some online thing. And I actually know, at least they said what company it was. I don't know if we're going to get sued if I say what it was.
Don't say it. There's plenty of companies out there.
It was definitely one of the companies that we see on commercials selling this stuff. And apparently one of their family members is a very thin female who has some alcohol struggles, but she is on it to help her stay thin. She has no obesity, no diabetes, no indication for this. And she's not doing it to help her reduce her alcohol, although they think maybe she has actually reduced her alcohol a little bit. But she's trying to get all of her friends to get on these compounded drugs to be skinny. And before we get into this compounded statement from the ADA, I at least want to make sure I am very clear that these medications are for those with real obesity, and the more risk or presence of obesity-related disease you have, you get more of the benefit compared to the risk. We go on here and we talk all the time about how we defend the risks of these medications. This is what we tried to do with Jillian, but she just yelled at us the whole time. But we acknowledge there are risks. They are drugs. They're not completely benign. We're not taking them. We wouldn't take drugs that have any type of risk compared to whatever benefit ratio. Someday, is it possible that they're going to put a shtickle of this into everyone's like routine because they end up being so safe and beneficial to prevent obesity and the complications downstream? Maybe, but boy, for right now, if you don't have obesity and obesity-related disease, there is zero indication to take these meds, let alone the compounded, bootlegged crap that you've started to kind of come around to more, but I have not. And I agree with the American Diabetes Association statement that they just published this week that we can talk about.
Well, yeah, I mean, people need to understand that there are risks there. Like, the benefits far outweigh the risks in the right indicated populations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, every time I make a comment about these drugs, my friend had an intestinal blockage. Again, not been shown in the trials. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. When you have millions of people doing this, maybe they'll become a signal over time. And we're seeing, you know, some of these lawsuits come out. But yeah. Like, again, these are small little cases. But if there is something there, you don't want to take the drug if it's not indicated. You're not going to get a lot of benefit. Yeah. You're going to get some vanity weight loss. And I do think it's probably safer than taking some of the other weird drugs and supplements that are out there.
But probably. At the same time, well, if it's the real stuff, but then of course we run into the whole issue of the real stuff versus, you know, what's indicated.
If it's not indicated for you, better not be taking branded stuff because you're really taking it from the people that need it.
Well, people shouldn't be prescribing it either in that case.
No, they shouldn't.
That's a whole other issue.
They absolutely should not be. So what did the ADA say?
The bottom line up front from the ADA on compounded GLP and dual GIP-GLP receptor agonists, which is basically essentially semaglutide and tirzepatide. Their bottom line up front is that non-FDA approved compounded incretin products, those are incretins, are not recommended for use due to uncertainty about content and resulting concerns about safety, quality, and effectiveness. And I completely agree with that just in general without even knowing all the nuances. They go on to say, if unavailable, like in the shortages, which has exposed this problem, switching to different FDA-approved medications is recommended on an individual basis for their weight, glycemic control, heart, kidney risk, all those other things. There is a fair amount of background that I know you've looked a lot into about why the FDA is even allowing this to happen right now. The FDA allows compounding copies if they are on an FDA shortage list to facilitate what they say is what is quoted here is the reason they allow this is to facilitate continuity of treatment and uninterrupted access.
Yes.
So I think that's an important little nugget that I hadn't really thought about before. The whole loophole in this is so people who really need them and are on them can continue to get them.
That's right.
But that is not what's happened.
No.
What's happened is our quack friends, unfortunately, and these companies online who aren't providing comprehensive obesity and diabetes care are really just selling access to these to people because they're a hot commodity. And I get that, right? But that's not what the loophole's for.
It's a big, big business. Yeah. So imagine if you have a shortage, you want to have a way to get around the patent so that people can get their medicine. What's going on, though, is people are exploiting the loophole and basically selling the drug to anybody and everybody who wants it with very little...
like people who apparently have no obesity, diabetes, thin, and then talk about the risks. Jeez.
And it's public. There are articles. News journalists have gone through some of these public companies and other companies and whether they are asked for any extra providing information to confirm that they are the weight and height and BMI, blah, 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 that they said they were in their intake. And oftentimes these places don't actually confirm that. So the law is there to make sure people continue to have access. What we're seeing now, though, is just an explosion. And I get it. The thing is, like what people will say in the comments is that you guys are elitist, you're big pharma greedy jerks, and that's not true either. The bottom line is that the drugs are too expensive. The shortage is an issue. Ideal world is that we would have these drugs in plentiful supply at costs.
Reasonable costs.
Yeah. Where if people insurance didn't pay for it, you could use cash. You know, you can go back to our kind of our direct primary care discussion the other day. But they're, you know, $1,000 a month. You can do Lilly Direct and get the branded stuff, and that goes up to five milligrams.
With the coupon stuff, both of them should be obtained for $650 a month. But that's a lot of money.
That's
still a ton of money. And trust me, we, you know, as much as people think we're shills for these big pharma companies, first of all, we're not. We don't get paid by them. I do appreciate the lunches they bring. But we talk all the time about how, you know, I get pissed because I feel like they just, you know, they have the direct to consumer marketing. Think about how much their TV commercials cost in the United States. The cost of these drugs are so much better in other countries. I mean, it really is bullshit. And I'll tell you what, if I did have a conflict of interest by speaking for them, or, you know, maybe we should just say screw it and be on their advisory boards, because I would advise them to quit doing that stuff and get the cost down so we can provide
they
better care for people.
To.
I know, but I'll, you know,
they wouldn't listen.
I mean, well, at least I could make some money trying, I guess.
Yeah, but then everybody's going to call you a shill.
Yeah, well, they do anyway. They call us a shill anyway. So it's like, well,
I know, but it's funny.
I might as well actually make the money.
It's funny to flaunt the, oh, yeah, go look it up. I love doing it. It just,
but
it
then
makes,
they look at mine, they're like, oh, you do get paid. I'm like, no, those are lunches for my staff because it's $100. A dumb year or something like that. Whatever it is.
It's not even worth it.
Yeah. Anyways, okay. So then I just found some other interesting little nuggets. So people say, well, what is the risk? What is the concern? So compounding ideally follows the United States Pharmacopeia monograph to standardize product quality. And the thing is, I think they have to be like generic maybe to do that if they're patented by the companies. I'm not exactly sure. But this monograph is not available for semaglutide or tirzepatide to help guide the standardization of the compounding meds.
So yeah, I had to go down this rabbit hole before. Semaglutide specifically has active pharmaceutical ingredient from Novo Nordisk, and they make it in their manufacturers. They make it recombinantly with yeast. And I'd like to go see this happening. They program these yeast to make these peptides. I don't know.
You tried to do it in your bathtub.
that wasn't semaglutide. I don't even know.
No, we just lost our sponsors for today. All right, go ahead.
I don't even know what that joke is. Nobody wants to sponsor us. But the API that these compounding places are using for semaglutide specifically, they're doing it synthetically, and that means they're doing it through chemical reactions. Novo Nordisk has just issued a letter to the FDA and wants semaglutide put on the demonstrably difficult to compound list. That means that nobody would be able to compound it, because what they're saying is that if you make it synthetically, these amino acids will start to aggregate, because it's a long chain of amino acids. If anybody remembers biochemistry, it's been a while for us, but chains of amino acids make peptides, and peptides make proteins eventually. But these little amino acids in a chain can then start aggregating. And what they're saying is that could happen with synthetically made. I don't know. Who knows if they're telling the truth or not?
It's like cooking eggs.
Denaturing, whatever. Denaturing a protein. But these things. And so what they're saying is that when they've sent this compounded synthetically made stuff off to get analyzed through the mass spectrometry. They're showing some impurities that shouldn't be there, and they don't even know what these impurities are, and what they're worried about is creating
immunogenicity.
Yes. Anyway,
that's all, folks.
Let's just leave now. I fucking quit.
Well, okay, so that
anyway,
so then,
no, but what that does, it, you what does could that develop antibodies to you okay. could develop immune reactions to this. You could develop antibodies. It could mean that you the drug will no longer be effective in the future. They don't it's not been studied to know what's going on. It's a big unknown. So what I've talked about this before. There's a difference in how some of these compounding pharmacies are putting this stuff together. There are 503B pharmacies. These are actually FDA registered.
And there they've been, by the way, this is, and if you look at this statement, it does say like we should only even be talking about the ones that are regulated by section 503A and B of the FD&C Act.
Yes. So the like, five, and so there are, and that's what, so there are some of these places, these online places using 503A, and it's a lot cheaper. I mean, these places are also making a lot of money from selling it. They say that we're big pharma shills and we make money, but these places are making hand over fist amounts of money because not only are they giving
ironic.
Access to the drug for a subscription fee, they're making money on top of that because they can buy it from these 503A pharmacies and then put it at whatever price that they want and pocket the rest. It's a big money making thing.
It's very direct shilling, and it's darn near illegal. I don't know how it's even legal, to be honest.
To me, it's unethical, whatever. So that's when I've talked to the 503Bs, what they're saying, it's so funny. Everybody's saying, no, it's the other people. They're saying, no, these concerns should only apply to the 503A. These 503B places do have their stuff together.
But this whole statement is talking about all of them. I mean, and it talks about how none of them are subject to bioequivalence testing.
Yeah,
they don't required for approved generic meds.
Yeah.
And so all these different ingredients that they put in them too to try to whatever, like the B12 and whatever, it impacts the pharmacokinetics, dynamics.
They have to make essentially a copy, which means that everything from the inactive to active ingredients must be the same.
So then what about how, and now this gets back to what you were talking about, what Novo says, they're also using salt forms of semaglutide, meaning, you know,
there shouldn't be any more of those rather than
the semaglutide base in the FDA approved forms.
That was kind of early days of the compound. There shouldn't be any more of those. And if there are, then that place should get shut down. But most of the places doing this right now aren't selling any of that stuff.
And then other thing is the dosing errors, of course, that comes with this because they're not coming in FDA approved, you know, dosing strategies and stuff. But we actually have to do some of that stuff with when we get the real medicines from different countries because we're trying to help people with cost effective dosing. So they're kind of, risk of dosing errors.
So people
there
are
too.
Like, why don't they just do the testing? Well, they don't have to because of this loophole. It's a catch 22.
They're not subject to it.
So then people are like, well, how do you, like, you can't say that they're unsafe. We can't say that they're safe. They haven't been studied. It's a big, it's a big
so
loophole.
Why do it?
I would trust some of these 503B places to help. I mean, okay. So
if you would let dad take it.
Yeah. So like,
and I know you wouldn't. So there you go.
I don't know. So here's the thing. Just listen though. Like is the risk.
No. Nope.
What if this person can't get the medicine? This is what the whole point of the 503B of being able to compound a patented drug. If the risk is that they have to come off the drug and regain a lot of their weight.
That's different though, because that's not what's happening.
I know. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that.
But now they're also paying for it because I guarantee insurance isn't going to cover those.
So here's the concern about the future. So if I'm launching my new clinic, online clinic, and everybody's asking me, are you going to do compound? Are you going to do compound? And I'm saying,
Jesus Christ,
no,
I hope not.
Because look, Novo Nordisk is. But as of it's December 6th right now, 2024, Ozempic and Wegovy, all doses are allegedly available. Globally, this still says on the FDA shortage list that there is a shortage, but it takes a while. So very soon, we're going to see whether it's taken off the shortage list. So imagine starting somebody on compounded, a bunch of people on compounded semaglutide or tirzepatide, as we're seeing. And tirzepatide, I'll get into that in a second. And then all of a sudden, Novo Nordisk and the FDA remove it from the shortage list. And legally, you cannot prescribe it. You cannot make it. Now I've just put all these people at risk for regaining their weight. It's going to be a very poor customer patient experience. And you were back into the same situation where if you gave everybody the coupon for free and now they can't afford it anymore, now they're all going to be mad and regain their weight. So it's not a good strategy for patient care, nor as a business strategy for anybody. Tirzepatide's the same way. They actually took tirzepatide off the shortage list.
I was going to say it was off for a second.
But then the outsourcing facility of compounding people sued the FDA. And what the FDA was going to decide on November 21st, again, it's December 6th, they were going to decide whether they made a mistake or not, or take it off the list and just keep going with it.
Yeah. They kicked the can get down off the road. List. It won't matter because they're going to
eventually
catch up. And I'll tell you what, I mean, and from a cost perspective, here's the other thing. So people whose insurance covers these doesn't cover the compounded bootlegged stuff anyways, right? And people say, oh, but it's cheaper and all the stuff. Well, we can also find ways to, you know, off-label dose the real stuff a little bit. But also, this is very interesting. So if you want to get into the politics of it, which we try not to because we get yelled at every time we do, but you know, the other countries have different dosing mechanisms. They're the real things, the real approved versions in their countries like the UK and Canada, and they're cheaper. And, you know, so that's, you know, in our clinic, we often use that when people are willing to pay something. We do have some people who pay the $550 for the small vial from Lilly Direct, and some people who pay the $650. But I'll tell you, those people are making the choice to sort of off-label extend their dosing because they still get a ton of benefit. So instead of the FDA-approved weekly dosing, they are choosing to do, say, every 10 days, every 2 weeks, cost savings, still a lot of benefit. But don't forget that a lot of people can really benefit from the cheaper, we'll call them first generation obesity medications. And for people who have type 2 diabetes, most of these medications we're talking about are going to be covered. So there's a lot more nuance to it. And that's another reason why, you know, online, and you will develop a very quality, comprehensive online obesity treatment program, I'm sure. But that's one of the concerns with a lot of these places. They just sell access to meds, the compounded meds. They don't evaluate them completely. People with obesity have a lot of risks and a lot of other things going on. They all need to be treated comprehensively, just like anybody with type 2 diabetes. Just because you have criteria for type 2 diabetes doesn't suddenly mean you get to have the comprehensive care. But if you don't quite meet criteria and you have prediabetes, fatty liver, heart disease, kidney disease, you still need very, very comprehensive obesity, cardiometabolic care. And a lot of these online places, they're just selling access to drugs, just like they're selling steroids, testosterone to guys saying they have low T, but they don't.
Hammer's dealers. Hammer's going to drop on them. I think a lot of this stuff will come out in the wash. Like, you can't just give access to these drugs. And because what I'm seeing from a business standpoint, especially, is that primary care doctors are starting to write it. So if you're selling a prescription, a subscription to get a prescription, why would people keep paying for that when you don't get much more value other than access to the medicine? So what they're going to go to their PCP who didn't prescribe it in the first place, maybe due to bias and stigma, but then all of a sudden they've lost 100 pounds, and the PCP goes, eh, whatever, I'll give you a year's worth of refills. And the person goes, huh, why am I paying $100 a month then for this other person that doesn't really do much for me other than just gives me a prescription when I need it? Then so from a business standpoint, I have to deliver a level of care that just goes way beyond what these other online
places are
doing.
Yeah, but not just business, because you actually care. I mean, want to provide comprehensive, real-life obesity care for the health of people, not just selling access to drugs.
No, it has. The business and care have to go together. They can't be separated, because once you start putting profits over patients, you're going to lose in the long run. Because it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. People, it's never worked.
It doesn't.
So
ill advised.
Any other hot takes? We, you know, if anybody listened to the Jillian Michaels podcast, that in the summer. By the way, that was in June,
and it got released
a couple weeks ago.
We knew she just kind of yelled and defended inappropriate stances on stuff the whole time, but we gave it a shot. We tried to calmly discuss the clinical context of these huge data sets and the risks versus the benefits. the ironic thing is that we obviously agree with her that everyone needs to be working on their nutrition, exercise, and that people who don't need these meds don't need these meds or shouldn't be given prescriptions. What she does, what she fails to understand is that whole risk to benefit ratio of the people who have real obesity.
She doesn't think anybody needs to be on these meds.
Well, I know, but that was what we tried to explain to her, and it didn't work.
She did not care. What's interesting is that we did it over Zoom, just for anybody, some of the background, and it sounded fine when we were doing it, but apparently our audio was adjusted. When she'd talk over us, nobody could hear what we were saying, and it's because it was Zoom, and I don't know if it kind of cut us off and protected her audio. I'm not really sure exactly. But, you know, there are a lot of people, her followers, you know, some classic, I'm glad you took these shills to town, whatever. but there were some of her followers that were kind of like, geez, Jillian, I'm going to become followers of theirs now because you just talked over them and they were trying to be reasonable where you just kind of yelled at them. So that it was an interesting experience. I didn't go in wanting to debate. I thought we were just going to have a discussion. It was bizarre. She kind of came out slinging, gunslinging right at the beginning. I was like, whoa, hold on a second here. Can't we just be reasonable and say that, like, yeah. Like, I just made a post on I make this silly Santa Claus post every year when it's Christmas time coming around. Anyway,
first of all, like, kids may be listening to this, so.
Yeah, so Santa Claus is real, my friends. But anyway, if there are kids that are listening to this, I don't know what to say. we're going to get in trouble probably from just that specifically. Anyway, I said basically diet and exercise aren't effective for resolving obesity. And when I say that, people get so mad, like, but if they just adhered 100%, then it would be effective. I'm like, no, you're talking about a calorie deficit. And even still, and I'm not, you know, trying to say thermodynamics and energy balance aren't true. When you think of like a therapy, think of prescribing a therapy of diet and exercise, even if you have the most intensive program with, you have a dietitian, all this stuff. When you look at like the strong gold standard randomized controlled trials where they did more intensive coaching and whatever than what we even do in the real world, by the way, a minority of people lose a very significant amount of weight. A lot, most people lose, wait, so clinically significant, meaning that 5 to 10%.
Yeah, that's kind of the average for the intensive trials.
And that's over about a year, by the way. So over after a year is done, it starts to dwindle. But what I'm talking about is when we start seeing that 15, 20 or so percent total body weight loss, it starts dwindling down into like 5 to 10, maybe 15%.
Oh, not even that.
Yeah,
not even that. I mean, it's really low,
and people get so.
That's because of the disease of obesity.
Well, yeah, but what the people will say is like, it's just because people don't stick to it, and I'm like,
right,
yeah.
That's because the biology works against.
Right, I'm not saying calorie deficits don't work.
On the other hand, though, to be fair, the reason you have close to 500,000 followers and I have none is because you make statements like that are not fully, there's no nuance to it. And you do to create outrage.
I explained
even though
it
it's not wrong, but
post.
It's like, yeah, I know. But I know how you play the game. You play it very well. But
it's
that's
time
what you
to
want
play
people
the
to
game.
Get pissed.
It's time to play the game.
Should we tag him in it? People don't even know what we're doing right now.
Anyways. It's time to play the game. Anyway, whatever. I guess we're big pharma shills, whatever. We don't make any money, but we're shills.
Yep.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Novo. Thanks, Lily.
Thanks
Viking.
For nothing.
We're open Viking and Amgen and who else is out there? I don't know.
All right. Well, maybe we're not going to have them sponsors. We need to get big, good quality food and exercise to sponsor us. So I don't know. We got to get our people to start getting some sponsorship for us.
Yeah. Who the heck? Someone's going to sponsor us.
Come on.
Spare us a crumb, please. All right, here's our outro. Share with somebody that's interested in GLP-1s, compounding, cardio-renal protection from these, and whoever else. Thanks.
Godspeed.
Bye.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.